Hello, and welcome to Mornings with Joel, Commercial Real Estate Podcast, where we focus on rising stars and established players in commercial real estate and talk to them about how they are building legacies in today's marketplace. Hey, welcome all to the Mornings with Joel CRE Podcast. We're very excited to have you with us today. And, you know, we've been talking about OZs, tax credits, things like that over the last week or so. And we have a special guest with us today that wanted to go into a little bit more detail. And even more so, we're going to talk about a case study as well as to how OZ money is still being used in this market today. Many people have felt that it's cooled off, but it's still live and well. And so let me introduce you to John Burlett. How you doing, John? What's happening, bud?
Hey, I'm doing terrific. Happy to be on your show with you guys today, Joe.
All right. Fantastic. So John, just give us a little bit about your background. Well, first of all, tell us who you are, right? Because I introduced you as an OZ guy, but let me let you tell that story. What do you do for a living?
All righty. Well, I'm happy to talk about myself, of course. My name's John Burnett. I'm the fund manager for Coastal Bend OZ Fund. Mm-hmm. We're based in Rockport, Texas. My background is in financial planning. I had a firm in Austin for a little over 40 years that I sold just as COVID was breaking out in March of 2021. And my focus was pretty much safe money, fixed income planning, tax planning, cash balance, pension plans, Roth conversions, and income planning for retirement plan. So that's who I am, my background. I was fortunate to sell my book of business in March of 21 and began a deep dive in opportunity zones.
Gotcha. How long have you been in the business of financial planning and advisory?
Pretty much all my adult life, over 40 years.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You look a little over 20. So I figured it might've been a while.
Yep. Started in 78, got licensed right out of the Army.
Okay.
And I had a finance MOS in the U.S. Army. So that was my background.
Gotcha. So I tell you what, before we get started, tell me a little bit about this background. I'm sure everybody's sitting there saying, what the heck is that? So why don't you explain that to us a little bit? Then we'll start diving into some meat of the subject.
Okay. Happy to talk about this. Is a city in Morocco called Chefchaouen, and it's also known as the Blue City, and it's up near Tangier, near the Mediterranean Sea and the Gibraltar area. And it's got a really fascinating story. Portuguese Jewish refugees settled there in the 1500s, and they felt like they'd gone to heaven, and they decided to paint the whole city blue because it reminds them of blue skies and heaven. They've later come to believe that blue repels mosquitoes.
Okay.
This is a city in Morocco I encourage everybody to visit if you ever get in that part of the country, which is in Africa, of course.
Right. Okay. All right. Interesting story. Thanks for sharing that. You know, everybody, when John and I were talking offline, I was asking him if that was some type of underwater world or something was going on there. So I was figuring how he was going to tie that into what we're doing. But interesting story there. So I appreciate that. And I understand you and your wife got engaged there. So a lot of history there for you. So wish you well with that. So, all right. So, John, so you said that you've been doing this roughly about 40 years in the 70s. You know, you were back knocking it out the park. So that's good stuff. And, you know, as we move forward in time, you know, tell us a little bit more about your more recent career. I know you were with Tandem Trust for a minute. And I think you still might have some ties with that. I'm not really sure. But how does that all work and tie into what you're doing today?
Well, that's a good question. I started my practice. A company name was Seniors Advisory Group.
Okay.
Then I realized seniors didn't like that word senior, so I changed it to Boomers Advisory Group. Okay. And that was the firm I actually sold. Now Boomers, the youngest ones, are born in 1964. So it's kind of making way for the next generation for planning. But my background, Tandem Trust Financial, is I had what's called a registered investment RIA firm. Mm-hmm. And I specialized again in retirement income planning with what's called fixed indexed annuities, which are very safe, protected from in Texas anyway, creditors, liens, lawsuits, and judgments. So that again was my background, and I really enjoyed doing tax planning. I'm not a CPA, I'm not a lawyer, so nothing I say should be construed as tax advice or, or any kind of legal counsel. So when I sold my practice, I had a no-compete for 2 years. A law firm that does estate planning type work purchased my book with the goal of doing estate planning work for my client base, which was average age 77.2. They did a lot of diligence, about 6 months of diligence on my practice before we came to a sale, a conclusion on agreeing on the terms of the purchase. So that's my background. If I answered your question correctly, Tandem Trust Financial is still a valid firm. I sold approximately 80% of the $50 million book of business that I managed.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic. So appreciate that. So now you've also have this OZ fund, and just to get your perspective on it, why did you decide that going into OZ investing and creating a fund was the way to go? As you know, there's a lot of talk about, should I do a fund? Should I not do a fund? Should I just do one off? Should I just raise the capital when I need it? Why did you go the route that you did and decide to create a fund and an OZ fund at that?
Well, I have a passion for real estate. I've formed several limited partnerships throughout my career in financial planning. I started buying tax lien properties in 1992 in Austin, Texas, using what's called a self-directed IRA. Kind of considered a pioneer in that space back in 92. It was very unheard of, not very well known as it is today, that you can use a self-directed IRA to purchase alternative assets. So although my business was focused on safe income planning, safe money, my passion for real estate was always in place. We ended up purchasing a property near Beaumont, Texas, in a place called Bridge City in 08, 45 days before Hurricane Ike made landfall and destroyed the whole city. Port Arthur, Bridge City was underwater. So I got it 45 days after we purchased the apartment complex, the first floor, all the buildings were underwater. Got a really quick education on managing that kind of risk. And we were fully insured, did rebuild totally out. But real estate's my passion, as you can tell from buying property at tax sales in 1992 at the courthouse steps. If interesting enough, at the courthouse sale, I went to the first sale. There was just two of us at that sale. We were still coming out of a pretty bad recession in the 80s. Yep. And the other gentleman was an attorney, and he told me there was 13 properties going for the opening bid. At that time, it was just 2 years worth of taxes due, and they put a ad in the local newspaper. So there was a sheriff's kind of a advertising fee. There's 13 properties, and this other gentleman who was experienced told me, now when I bid, you don't bid. And if you decide to bid, I won't bid. So we made kind of a deal, the two of us, and we bought everything in opening bids.
Wow. Gotcha.
Tell you what, I decided when I sold my business, I'd been hearing bits and pieces about opportunity zones that came out of 2017 tax code and Jobs Act. If those on the program who may not be aware of the tax law. And just, decided, what? I've got a little capital gain here. I'd like to do a deep dive. And it gets really interesting. I decided to go buy a motorhome off the showroom floor. My wife and I began to travel 17 states looking at opportunity zones to decide where we want to deploy our eligible capital gain.
Okay. All right. So you started traveling around. You were looking for opportunity zones in different cities. Was that just, well, you said 17 states. So obviously, you were looking at different states as well. But how did you make the decision to do a fund as opposed to not do a fund? What was your thought process behind that?
I don't think I really considered investing into an established fund. There are many out there that are really leaders in this space. that I've come to know about. I wasn't aware of any established funds. And so me, it really wasn't a consideration. I'm kind of entrepreneur, real estate focused mind. I understand the risk associated with real estate. So I don't know that I gave any consideration to doing anything other than establishing my own fund. Okay. I reached out to some legal firms that were in the private placement space, mm-hmm. got some counsel, and established right away I wanted to set up my own fund.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. So you kind of went straight to it. And I understand you've been investing in Opportunity Zones for a period of time now. You have one particular deal that's kind of note, because it's kind of if I understand correctly, a rebuild situation from the destruction of another hurricane. And then, you know, but it's hospitality. And so you got COVID, you got all these things going on. And I kind of want to dive into that a little bit deeper as well. But give us a little bit of the backstory of this case study that, you know, you were going to share with us today.
Okay. Before I do, let me tell you about my journey in the motorhome in 17 states.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I thought that you were done with that. No, but that's so, fine. Go ahead.
Let's start there. We actually looked at hundreds and hundreds, literally, of these designated opportunity zones. Mm-hmm. And I know you know this, Joe, but there is over 8,000 of these geographic locations designated by each state governor's mm-hmm. office. And you had to be in the lowest 25% income census tract to be designated as an opportunity zone. So we bought the motorhome off the showroom floor in Las Vegas. We started looking through Arizona all the way into California. Amazingly, we drove up and down the streets of San Francisco pulling a trailer in this 35-foot motorhome, mm-hmm. which was pretty exciting. We looked at some opportunity zone properties near the Silicon Valley area, a city called Alviso, mm-hmm. near the bay. And then we took off through Utah, Colorado. We spent some time doing some diligence on a mall in northwestern Colorado. Actually went under contract on that mall. That was in a town where the coal mines had are going away. And so a lot of jobs were very depressed community. Mm-hmm. We went through the Midwest, went through Texas, originally down to Boca Chica, where Elon Musk is doing the SpaceX operation. And mm-hmm. all the speculators had gotten there before us and drove the prices up sky high. And went through this town where we ended up purchasing some property. I'll come back to that, called Rockport, Texas, mm-hmm. Corpus Christi. And we went up to the Northeast in the Niagara Falls area looking at opportunity zones. Spent some nice time in the Finger Lake area. I forget, there's an old racetrack in that neighborhood, somewhere near Syracuse. We spent a few days there, had a really nice time. Okay. Then took off down to the Gulf Coast and looked at property real seriously on the Gulf Coast near Biloxi, Gulfport area, mm-hmm. before coming back to Rockport. And this area just kept jumping out at me. We ended up finding an old property that had in the hotel district that was called the Oleander Courts.
Okay.
Some old cottages had been built in the 40s. And Hurricane Harvey had made landfall in Rockport, destroyed about 50% of the structures here, including our city hall, our county courthouse, the art center. It's a major rebuild coming now, almost 6 years. August will be 6 years since Harvey made landfall here. Mm-hmm. But there's an abundant supply here, and it's a bit of an anomaly when you think of opportunity zones. What's really I've determined here is there's so many second homeowners that live in San Antonio, Austin, Houston. So they report their incomes where they live and reside. So it's kind of, you know, they have second homes here, which the people that live here and are in the service sector or retired. And the town is just historically for probably 80 years known as the number one fishing destination in Texas. The locals refer to Rockport as a drinking town with a fishing problem.
Okay.
So it's definitely bird watchers come here, seeing what they call winter Texans. Snowbirds travel here as they go, you know, during the winter months. So it's a very unique property, the property we acquired is three blocks from the bay. It's outside of the floodplain. And again, it's in the historic hotel district.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha. So you acquired this property, and at this particular point in time, was there anything standing because of the hurricane that had come through, or was it, so was it a remodel job? Was it a ground up construction job? How did that actually go?
Definitely a demolished job.
Okay. Okay.
We demolished the structures in November, the fall of 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had to get a city permit to asbestos was found in the floors and in the windows. And so we had to go through remediation and got it all demoed. Two-thirds of the site, it's almost 3 acres. So the front third was already had the hotel zoning. The back two-thirds was residential. We ended up going through a rezoning process with the city to get the entire tract zoned as R6 hotel so we could get some height. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, Joel, it's a rebuild from ground up. And we have now a 60-unit boutique, upper-scale destination mixed-use property called the Blue City Paraíso. And it's designed after the city you see in behind me in Morocco is our theme. And it's very unique to this area. There's been no new hospitality built since Harvey destroyed about 50% of the properties here. And the trend here is off the charts with vacation. I think COVID contributed tremendously to this becoming a 3-hour drive from Houston, San Antonio, and Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of history, if we have time, I'll go into about Rockport and what makes it so special. But to answer your question, it's a total ground up. We've got a high-end spa boutique, spa with Moroccan-themed treatments, mm-hmm. Hydrotherapy. We have a rooftop lounge and a conference center along with a restaurant as well. So it's definitely a destination boutique hotel development project.
Okay. All right. Well, that's awfully interesting. So take me through the timeline again, because you said you acquired the property. Was it 11? You said you bought it. Was that the year?
August of 2021.
Oh, of 21. Okay. All right. So yeah. August of 21, you acquired it. And that was kind of right in the middle of all that was going on with COVID. Back at that time. So hospitality was really, really beat up, you know, to say the least. And when did you actually start construction on it?
We have not broke ground. We have got permitted. We just received 2 weeks ago our infrastructure permit from the city,
mm-hmm.
which was quite extensive. Took 5 months, or actually a little closer to 6 months from when we submitted the civil site plan. But thank God we finally got it. You know, there's something to be said about the good old boy system here in Texas. I don't know if others have it, but it's somewhat political. I feel like I've kind of broken through that network somewhat. Being the new guy in town, I lived in Austin 44 years. I relocated here on boots on the ground. I was fortunate to get appointed to the Tourism Development Council, part of the Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And that's allowed me to have access to a lot of data related with hospitality. One of my biggest challenges is having no background in hospitality space and also in development, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had to learn quite a bit. I am fortunate to be here, located here, actually one block away from the site. And we anticipate breaking ground this fall, assuming we're successful with our capital raise. And we get our construction drawings are probably close to 70% along mm-hmm. right now. We feel like by the end of September, we'll be submitting our full construction plans for a permit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one reason why I did want to talk to you about this, because it's, you know, I definitely see some challenges, you know, here, and the ability to work through them certainly is incredible, you know, from that standpoint. So, you mentioned about development experience. You had to check that box. You had to check the box on hospitality experience. You have to get debt for the project, construction financing for hospitality, which has historically been difficult. It's not a name brand hotel, you know, from that standpoint, it's a boutique. And I'm assuming your OZ fund would be putting in the equity that's necessary for the deal. Is that the way you're structured?
Yeah, exactly. We are set up with it's a $16 million project, $237,000 per door. Mm-hmm. And I'll get into the mix, the room mix here, if that's of any interest to anybody. But it's a $16 million. We have an $8 million debt stack and an $8 million equity raise.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very on the threshold of raising the first million. We're at $930,000. So we're really close to really being well underway on the equity side. It has been a struggle in this economy. I am determined to bring on a co-GP at this point, someone who ideally has experience in development and hospitality and also some capital connections. I feel like that's what we need to get this thing to the finish line. And we have some conversations currently going with at least one huge player in the OZ space that has meets all those boxes. The debt is pretty much in place. We have two term sheets, both reputable lenders that we have not executed. We have completed a feasibility study. It came back even more favorably for our market than I anticipated. I'm really shocked at what the feasibility study came back with. Again, the occupancy tax collection revenue for the city is at all-time highs.
Mm-hmm.
Corpus Christi is just 30 miles to the south of us, and they've reached all-time hospitality room nights this summer. The port of Corpus Christi is the number one shipping port for tonnage in the U.S., fourth largest, deepest port. So we got a lot of good economic signs close by. Our community, Rockport, does not want any of the refineries, any of the plants, the factories that are but here to the south of us. What they really want and all they want for the most part is tourism. We're home to the number one beach, Blue Wave Beach, the only Blue Wave designated beach in Texas, very clean beach, friendly for families, shallow. No shark sightings that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, very, very interesting from that standpoint. So, all right. Well, we'll see how that plays out over time and go from there. What are your objectives with your OZ fund? You know, how much are you looking to raise in totality? Because I'm assuming this won't be your only deal from that standpoint. I mean, what are your plans going forward?
But we do plan to scale the concept once we get stable, year two or year three. We have an extensive pro forma available should anybody be interested. We do plan, our fund is a $25 million offering under Reg D 506C, and only for accredited investors. The immediate plan is to secure a co-GP, like I mentioned earlier, that has those talents and experiences in place. Once we get open, operational, stable, we believe the concept is scalable. We have Biloxi on our radar screen and also Puerto Rico. I visited Puerto Rico earlier this year. A lot of additional incentives you're probably aware of associated with Puerto Rico on top of the OZ. So I have a friend, a legal attorney that specializes in opportunity zones, describe the whole concept as 1031 exchange got married to Roth IRA, and they had a kid, they named him Oz, O-Z, named Oz. So it's really the tax incentives for those of you who choose to educate yourself and get up to speed are phenomenal. And are in very valuable for certain people and even family offices, etc.
Yeah, gotcha.
We do have a multifamily on our horizon.
Okay.
We actually have three sites in this county. We're all in the Coastal Bend, which is a region of Texas. It's about 70 miles coastal region, just north and south of Corpus Christi. Interesting fact about Rockport, a lot of people don't know, especially outside of Texas, is there's a lot of oil money here. The Bass Brothers out of Fort Worth, their uncle Sid Richardson, acquired the largest privately owned island in America, which is 3 miles offshore here in Rockport, called San Jose Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, for those who don't know, the Sid Richardson and the Bass Brothers are a very wealthy family. They've been coming here and they've entertained presidents all the way back from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Eisenhower, Bush, and many other dignitaries on this island. So it's kind of a secretive deal. It's mm-hmm. just 3 miles offshore, and they have their own landing strip. It's a big cattle operation and oil operation. So our number one most famous person that just loves Rockport is George Strait. He has a second home here. If you call City Hall and ask him to put you on hold, you'll hear a commercial from George Strait talking about how he just loves to get away and come to Rockport and spend time here in Rockport. So there's a lot. The Benson family from New Orleans Saints fame has a presence here. So Texans kind of get Rockport.
Mm-hmm.
People that are not familiar with Texas, for the most part, have a hard time getting why I chose to deploy my capital in this location. It's 10,000 population, 7.5% of the population are professional fishing guides.
Hmm.
If you can imagine, it's like, that's a pretty strong 7.5%. 750 people make their living as professional fishing guides.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So must be some good fishing down there. Maybe I'll get down there one day.
You got an open invitation, Joe. We'll go out and get some reds and trouts. And we're in a bay, by the way. We're not on the Gulf.
Okay.
We're on a large bay called Aransas Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a difference. I'm not a fisherman myself, but there's the offshore fishing where they go for tunas. And then there's the bay fishing, which is more. Actually, there's another story about Rockport that involves the Vietnamese population came here in the 70s and mm-hmm. 80s and how they set up huge oyster and shrimping operations throughout, the good times for that business. Kind of died off now, but there's still a lot of oyster farming going on here.
Yeah, I got it. Hey, I did want to ask you also about, the fund model, again, is always a debate in this side of the industry, whether you do it or not do it. And you answered that earlier. I did want to ask you, though, because you show Veritas, who I'm very familiar with in your paperwork. Have you found that a value in getting everything structured and put together, being able to use that platform?
You mean Veribest?
Veribest. Test. Sorry about that.
Yeah, they do background checks, pretty extensive on the principles of the fund. And I do have a pretty good team that we've got built out. I'd like to mention my advisory general counsel is a securities attorney in Michigan, Patrick Sugru, and he's also a national expert in the subject of opportunity zones. And regarding, there's some timely information available regarding what's called the Safe Harbor plan that, the government declared just recently, May 11th, I believe it was, the COVID is officially over or ended.
Mm-hmm.
However, it caused a deadline coming up in September now, where all opportunity zones are required to have this Safe Harbor financial written plan in place, a working capital, and it has to be reported twice a year. So that, in fact, looks like Patrick is joining on the webinar here now. Happy to turn this over to Patrick if you have any legal questions that he might can answer. Patrick is currently on the arbitration FINRA review panel in Michigan. So again, he's up on a lot of the legal aspects of having an offering like that. Hello, Patrick. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. Have you been on the call or just getting here?
I'm just logging in.
Yeah, he just got here.
Okay. Awesome.
All right. Well, Patrick, didn't know you were joining today, but happy to bring you in. Let me see if we can pin you on the screen here. There we go. And talk to you as well. So thanks for joining. So I'll tell you what, introduce yourself and then we'll see what questions we can fire at you. Like I said, I wasn't prepared to question you, but we'll make it happen.
Okay. Pleasure to be here. Nice to meet you, Joel. Mm-hmm. My name is Patrick Chagru. I am a partner in the Business Law Group, which is a boutique business transactional law firm headquartered in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but with a national practice in business transactions, financial transactions, securities offerings, and mergers and acquisitions. A specialty of ours has been, over the last 5 years, qualified opportunity zone projects, real estate developments, and business developments. Mm-hmm. And I've been pleased to meet John Burlett and be a colleague with him in some of the online environments and networks of opportunity zone stakeholders. And that's how I found out about his project and fallen in love with his project. And I'm pleased to be a member of his team to provide some guidance and some advice on qualified opportunity zone compliance.
Gotcha. All right. That's fantastic. So I guess first thing I would ask is, what are the alligators that people need to look out for if they're going to create an opportunity zone fund? What do they need to basically look out for? What's the traps, if you will, or the landmines?
Right. So it depends on what kind of a fund mm-hmm. they are creating. We sort of loosely call them what I would call personal or family or self-directed qualified opportunity funds. That's more in line with what would be a small family office, if you will, where you're investing family assets, family capital gains are going to be deferred, and investing in projects which the family or the small group controls or yourself. Mm-hmm. That's what we call a self-directed QOF or qualified opportunity fund. And in that case, the rules are the same in terms of the timing of making sure your gain gets deferred. It's an eligible gain, not with the gain is created with unrelated parties, et cetera. So the rules are going to be the same between the self-directed fund and what we would call and what John Roulette has here in Coastal Bend Opportunity Fund, which is what I call a syndicated qualified opportunity fund. In that case, John's company is set up to be compliant as a qualified opportunity fund in gathering investments from those seeking opportunity zone tax benefits who simply need to join as a passive investor, and their gain will be deferred and the potential exclusion of appreciated capital gain during a 10-year holding period would be accomplished through John's qualified opportunity fund called Coastal Bend Opportunity Fund. Mm-hmm. The good news for the investor in that case is that John and his staff will do the administration of the opportunity fund, which includes tax filings every year and some initial tax filings and asset tests and other tests that need to be run inside of the fund for the investor. So that is a good thing. However, deals like John's don't have to have all opportunity zone investors. In fact, I think last count when you were looking at dollar amount, John, about half of your investors in your fund have invested capital gains that they're seeking to defer and make eligible for gain exclusion on the back end, and half of them do not.
That's correct. Yep.
So, So there's a lot of pitfalls, Joel. There's the rules are complex. It's not waters you want to swim in without going with a guide, if you will, mm-hmm. because there are deadlines, there are asset tests, and it's really hard to fix them retroactively. When John and I first got into this space, a lot of folks got really excited about doing real estate developments, family businesses, whatnot, under the opportunity zone tax benefit scheme, but the regs weren't written for close to 2 years. And so we've had to kind of unpack and backload, if you will, some of the sand behind the seawall in some early deals. But now there is much better guidance. And so I would say seek out a qualified advisor, your accountant, your financial advisor, your attorney or an attorney that knows about it or CPA that knows about it. Get some guidance before you step into that space of doing your own qualified opportunity fund, Joel.
Yeah, yeah. And that actually leads me right back to, because you kind of really set it up real well for me. It leads back to the question that I had asked John earlier. I was like, why go through the brain damage to create a fund in the first place? I mean, and I'm not saying not to do it, but I was just trying to figure out his logic behind it. And, you know, kind of want to ask you the same thing. I mean, what would be the, because the other side of it is just to raise the capital as you need it. Obviously, you don't have the investor pool that might need to defer to capital gains, but you, like you said, you have investors that don't necessarily need to do that. So what in your opinion and in thought process is the reason to go through all the brain damage to create an opportunity zone fund as opposed to not doing that?
Well,
it might be a loaded question, but yeah.
Yeah, that's got at least 3 to 5 heads on it, but that's a good question. In John's case, I can tell you, you know, John started his project by seeding with his own capital gain investment, qualified opportunity zone investment, his own project. So he's invested in CBOZ fund the same as other investors are with an eligible gain. I mean, I think that's really good for a sponsor to be there shoulder to shoulder with other qualified opportunity zone investors in the same fund. But it's not always the case. I think these projects, which I mean, the tax benefits and the bump to the after-tax internal rate of return are significant for a compliant 10-year hold and a favorable exit in a qualified opportunity fund investment. When you have a situation like Rockport, Texas, which is an area which I think in John's materials, hopefully you talked about Dr. Lee, who had commented about, you know, Rockport is looks to be the kind of town that's going to be recession proof if we do have a recession, because it is developing so quickly. And with the tendency of folks to vacation close to home or in ways that they don't have to get on an airplane, which is kind of a big deal now, there's a huge draw of car traffic within 3 to 4 hour drive of Rockport that's just there to make Rockport into what the economic developers there are trying to make it into and are already making it into, which is a tourist destination area.
Yeah, gotcha. And so if a person was to say, hey, you know, Patrick, I'm thinking about creating this OZ fund, but I'm trying to figure out, is it worth it or should I just raise capital outside of that? You know, what's your response to that? Is it mainly the tax benefits and that additional pool of investors you have access to? Or is there another response you would give somebody like that?
Again, if you have your own, if you're expecting capital appreciation in the investment and you intend to hold it for a long term, it doesn't have to be the full 10 years because you can roll from one qualifying investment into another if you follow the rules. But you're going to be looking for a long-term hold and in an investment that's likely to appreciate in value. In that case, if you happen to have eligible gain from another transaction, sale of stock, sale of a business or whatever, sale of a business in John's case, you know, why not take that gain in that holding tax-free if it qualifies as an opportunity zone investment? Yeah. So that would be the motivation. I would say this, though, about that. We often hear about smaller deals, folks that buy investment, rental properties, et cetera, buy and fix up or whatever. You know, if the investment, the qualifying gain isn't $50,000 to $75,000 that you're investing or that is being invested in the deal, then the amount of compliance and learning curve is quite high And I would say the cutoff would be 75 to 100,000 of investment coming in as eligible gain, looking for that deferral and then exclusion after a 10-year hold. If it isn't that to that extent, then you're probably doing a beta test and it may not be worth it.
Yeah, yeah. But no, that's good to know. I mean, I wasn't even thinking about those smaller tiers like that, but thank you for sharing that, because that is good to know as well. But I get your point. You know, you basically have a individual that has capital gains, and he's basically saying, look, I'm going to do this deal and I'm going to be in it. Obviously, you trust me. I'm looking to bring you in it as well. If you've got capital gains, we can ride this thing together and basically make this happen. I was looking at it from the other side also, because generally, if you exit in a shorter window, you have a greater IRR and you don't have all the restrictions oftentimes related to having to keep that money deployed for that full 10 years. But it depends simply on where do you want to be. As you mentioned, if you have someone that's going to stay in the deal long term, then, you know, that's fine. You know, even if most deals trade 5 to 7 years, staying in, you know, up to 10 is not the end of the world, you know, especially if you're putting your own capital in. And if you got capital gains, you got to defer. You have the option of going into somebody else's fund, but then that's not giving you the same joy of managing the fund and actually controlling the deal.
Right.
So yeah, right. I can understand
some,
that as
some
well.
People would, I would just say, Joel, some people would say the same headache in managing your own fund, because there is responsibility for compliance. But yeah, I mean, you, if in the process of developing your 10-year hold for your opportunity zone investment, if you do exit early, then there is the possibility of rolling the amount of your original investment, that gain, into another qualifying investment within a 12-month period, and you have the same holding period towards your 10 years. Now, if there's appreciation beyond your original investment, that's going to be a new gain, which doesn't roll. But if they are, if this happens before the end of 2026, or if they do as we expect in Washington, and Congress can get together and the president can sign the pending or the proposed amendment in the last Congress that would extend the opportunity zone investment window to the end of 2028, then if you do incur an interim capital gain, you then can distribute it out and reinvest it in another QOF or QOZ project through a QOF. And then you just have two QOF investments, different holding periods, but to continue that chase towards gain deferral until the end of the investment period, and then 10-year hold towards a tax-free exit.
Okay. Okay. You actually,
the other thing I'll point out, Joel, real quick, if it hasn't been covered yet, in a real estate deal, really, really important that on exit in a real estate deal in a qualified opportunity zone qualifying investment, not only is the capital gain excluded, but there is no recharacterization as recapture. So no recapture in the exit of an opportunity zone investment. Whereas I think for those that have invested in real estate, it's not always all capital gain at the end of your exit. You have to recapture accelerated depreciation or bonus depreciation as ordinary income. Does not happen in a qualified opportunity zone investment.
Okay. All right. No, that's good to know. I appreciate you bringing that up. And, generally the mindset is you're locked into that OZ for 10 years, but what you're describing is interesting. You can actually exit and roll it over from that standpoint. Obviously, if you pay out investors with some type of capital event, you know, if they exit, they're going to have to deal with the tax ramifications of exiting early. I mean, that's going to happen. You know, let's say if they don't roll forward is what I'm getting at. But and am I correct in saying that?
You are correct. And also, particularly in real estate projects, and John's is no different, after a project is developed, constructed, and stabilized, there's typically a refinancing event.
Right.
Any construction debt is paid off with permanent debt, and the project is leveraged up to a reasonable point that will maximize internal rate of return on a risk adjusted basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. John would project that for his project as well. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of that refi transaction is that all of the investors will get tax basis in their holding to the extent of their share of the debt, proportionally allocated to them. So that way, if there is excess funds not needed for operations from the refi, it can be distributed out to the investors, and it reduces their basis. It's not taxable unless the amount of the distribution exceeds their tax basis, like any other real estate deal.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Those are some of the nuances that are, oftentimes hid away in these type of structures that make sense.
Yeah, Joel, there's a lot of planning that goes on during this holding period. And it is a long time, and people's objectives and family circumstances or business circumstances do change. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it's good to have your accountant get familiar, your tax preparer get familiar with these rules. And if there is a planning event, change of circumstances, contact folks in the industry that have some experience in this area from a planning standpoint, and you will have some options.
Gotcha. Now, one thing I forgot to do, because you kind of came in the middle of the broadcast here, is to open it up to Q&A. I don't know if there's any questions out there. Lee, if you have any on LinkedIn, we can pull those in as well. But if you have any questions, either raise your virtual hand or put that in the chat, and we'll be sure to get you on the, we'll be sure to answer your questions. So, all right. So, no, I think that's really good information from that standpoint, because generally, like if you have a situation here where you said you have half the people that are invested because of capital gains and then half the people that are not, then at that capital event, when the refi takes place, everything kind of gets reset, and those people might want to exit. Those early investors that don't have the capital gains issue to deal with can actually exit at that point in time and realize a decent IRR and still be into an opportunity zone deal.
Well, that's correct, Joel, but that would only be the case if the deal does provide for a redemption out on an investor by investor basis versus a sale of the entire project, right? And the deal's done for everyone. Most private deals don't have liquidity of just give notice that I want to get out and I can get out.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes sponsors will, as you know, make a market with other investors or gobble it up if they have the resources to do so. But it's not a ready liquid market to exit these real estate investments. And it wouldn't be in a private opportunity fund either.
Gotcha. Okay. So at that time of the, let's say if there was a capital event, a refinance, let's say in year five, when the property is stabilized, I was under what the impression of what you were saying is that individuals could get out if they didn't have the, if they didn't go in for the capital gains protection, if they just went in as a regular investor, then they could actually exit in year five and then deal with the tax consequences at that point in time. Not going in for the capital gains.
Yeah, the ability of when they can exit, Joel, is going to be dictated by the terms of their operating agreement and whether an exit opportunity, a redemption opportunity is presented in that document. And that's outside of the whole opportunity zone.
Right. Sort of scheme. So let's make that assumption. Comment,
yeah.
Well, let's make that assumption. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, let's make that assumption. Let's say the operating agreement says year five, we'll have a capital event. The property will be stabilized. We'll refinance. And if I or anybody else was an investor not needing the capital gains protection, could I exit at that point in time and receive my proceeds?
Yeah. If the operating agreement said that the manager or managing partner has the right to make those redemption offers and people can step up on a first come, first serve or proportionate basis. Yeah. The company could do that. It's going to have some funds available when it refis favorably.
Right.
But if everybody stays in the deal and what usually happens, in these deals is people are kind of expecting a 5 to 7 to 8 year hold anyway in a real estate deal, but they'll get that interim refi distribution. mm-hmm. which is not exiting the deal. It's just a distribution on their equity. Mm-hmm. And most of these deals are structured, and John's is structured such that the Class A investors, the passive investors, get a priority on the distributable cash from the refi event to the extent of return of 100% of their investment mm-hmm. Before there's a sharing with the sponsor shares. And that is the same. That is true, and in most QOF deals, and it's true in John's deal as well. So you're in the deal, but your cheese is out of the trap on the refi. You got your money back.
Right, right.
Okay. You're still hanging around for that appreciation, though, on exit.
Right. Okay. Well, no, that's good to know. I appreciate you kind of delineating that and clarifying it from that perspective. That's very good. So we're actually down to about 7 minutes. No messages have come in just yet. There might be some out there on LinkedIn. I know Lee's working on that. But John, is there anything that you wanted to fill in here? You kind of been quiet sitting over there for the last 20 minutes.
Yeah. Thanks for joining in, Patrick, and sharing all the legal knowledge that you have. I'd like to just mention our ad in our particular project. We have set up what's called a QOZB, Qualified Opportunity Zone Business, where we actually have three income streams from the QOZBs. And there's some nuances associated with all that as far as what's called working capital, safe harbors, and that sort of thing. But we have, I'll just remind the listeners, we have the rooftop lounge restaurant component, which is a Qualified Opportunity Zone Business. We have the high-end spa. We have the a conference center, which is going to generate revenues, the swim up bar, in addition to our hotel room mix. So if there's anything that makes sense to discuss along the QOZB side, we could happy to add that to the conversation.
All right. I appreciate that. What I don't want to do is turn the podcast into a commercial. So, we'll stay a little bit away from that. But obviously, if anybody wants more information so that they can look into this as an investment for themselves, certainly reach out to us. We'll get you in touch with John and y'all can work that out. So we'll make sure everybody knows that. Yes, Patrick.
Just to highlight what John said and for the folks either on right now or that'll look at this later. They'll see a lot of these opportunity zone investments have this two-tiered structure that John described, where the investment of the investor that has the gain, or in John's case, you can not be an opportunity zone investor. It goes into this thing called a qualified opportunity fund. Mm-hmm. That fund simply takes that capital, and it as a fund makes an equity investment in what's called a qualified opportunity zone business. And so that the fund ends up owning equity interests in what we call the QOZB, qualified opportunity zone business. Mm-hmm. And this has become standard practice in particularly real estate opportunity fund deals, development deals, because going through the business gives the opportunity zone business and holding the equity interest in your fund, that allows for greater flexibility in the asset tests that have to be measured during the entire holding period. 70% of the assets in a qualified opportunity zone business has to be qualified opportunity zone business assets. But it also gives a development period called a working capital safe harbor of between 31 and 62 months to finish the project before the opportunity zone business has to follow what's called a 5% non-qualified asset test and also the regular asset test for the opportunity zone business. So I know I'm getting way in the weeds, but there are a lot of tests that the QOF manager has to keep their eye on to make sure that the investment, even if it's two-tiered, it's still working and still compliant.
Yeah. Very good point. Patrick, this is, I'm glad you joined. There was a lot of additional information that you were able to bring and insight into the structure of these type of deals. And that's really what we try to accomplish here, is to make sure that we're educating the public on matters like this and why they should look at opportunities like this, because they understand what goes into them. And a lot of times if people don't have that education, they just shy away from it. So I certainly appreciate you filling that in. John, I want to thank you for bringing Patrick in as well. I think that was a good idea because he certainly was able to bring a lot of value. So Patrick, I do thank you for that. And certainly
my pleasure, Joel.
Yeah. So we're pretty much out of time here. Were there any final words that you want to share with us for our audience today?
I'll just share. Thanks so much for allowing me to be on your podcast and reach your audience and share our message and get the word out there. I appreciate what you're doing and your team.
Good. Thank you.
I would echo that, Joel. I congratulate you on getting into this subject matter, because while it's out there and people have heard about it, it is a bit scary, even to accountants and lawyers and tax preparers, because it is kind of technical. And from an investment person like yourself, there is a learning curve that is unavoidable. And mm-hmm. for you to take part in being part of that learning curve to take advantage of this, as those in Washington, Senator Tim Scott, for example, said, it is the most significant tax benefit ever produced by Congress, that also has the effect of impact investing and creating greater opportunity in what was previously economically distressed areas. It's a win-win for everyone. So it is important to know about it. And congratulations to you for being part of that educational process.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. If you look at the type of guests that we have on in our audience, it's people really deep in the real estate business on the commercial side. So this is the type of information that's needed in order to even have them diversify their assets and investments, as it relates to getting involved in things. So I really appreciate it. I'm sorry, okay, Patrick.
I was going to say, Joel, if your audience does have questions and they reach out to you, you're certainly feel free to contact me. I'll share my contact information with you. And if I can help you and any of your audience maybe understand a little bit better, that's a big part of my mission as well.
Yeah. No, I greatly appreciate that. So, just once we go off live, put that in the chat and we'll talk a little bit offline as well. But I certainly thank you for it. We're going to close out on that note. So I want to thank you all for listening today. This has been the Mornings with Joel CRE podcast. A very, very insightful conversation related to OZ Zone investing. And we thank you for being here today. Have a great afternoon. You've been listening to Mornings with Joel, Commercial Real Estate Podcast, where we focus on rising stars and established players in commercial real estate and talk to them about how they are building legacies in today's marketplace. Please check back weekly to hear our upcoming guests.